Hey folks, once again, here we are with Felicia mispronouncing a critical word throughout the entire recording. When I told Julia about this discovery, she said, do we have to re-record it? And I said, heck no, I've said it at least 25 plus times. So it'll probably be a little annoying, but I'd rather it be a little annoying than me mispronouncing the name of a pupil group for about an hour plus. So sorry again, but be entertained, for once again, we have a reoccurrence of the Mr. Black.
Hi, kids! Welcome to Camp Krusty! I'll see you in a few weeks. Until then, I've turned things over to my bestest buddy in the whole wide world.
Mr. Black.
I want you to treat
Mr. Black
with the same respect you would give me. Now here's
Mr. Black.
So, without further ado, enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Royal Diaries, Unlocking History. My name is Felicia.
My name is Julia. We are sisters who love books, history, and talking about them both.
We're doing a deep dive into the Royal Diaries series.
Come with us as we learn about the girls who became women that shaped history.
Anna Kona, Golden Flower, Haiti, 1490, by Edwig Danticat. Beginning in 1490, Anna Kona keeps a record of her life as a possible successor to the Supreme Chief of Yagzura, as wife of the Chief of Mangua, and as a warrior battling the first white men to arrive in the West Indies, ravenous for gold.
I mean, a very appropriate summary.
Well, they did it correctly. I'm glad I didn't have to write it one myself.
I know.
So, this book.
This book.
New? Brand new?
Yeah, brand new.
Do you know why this is actually brand new? Because this was the last book added to our collection. Because at this point, I officially had stopped collecting.
Mm-hmm.
These books had gone out of print. I embarked on this project.
Well, we, excuse
sorry,
you.
Sorry.
Excuse you.
This is Julia Erasier.
We embarked
on this project. And then I said, well, this is great, except I don't actually have all 20 books. I'm missing the last two. And Michael, the real MVP, silent
supporter
of the pod, went out and bought us the last two. So this was from the library of Madeline Pulzer. So thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, Madeline Pulzer.
For selling your book.
Yeah.
So we could buy it to read it.
We greatly appreciate it.
So this was our first time reading it. So
yeah, completely.
Actually.
Yeah.
So what did you think about reading it? How was it?
Here are my thoughts on this book. A couple of things. One, I did not understand her timekeeping system at all. I'm an idiot. I don't know how the moon works. Sorry to our moon fans out there. No clue. I'm like, and then also there seemed to be like some jumping in time. A page later, suddenly her brother is 5 wives, and then suddenly he has 7, then he has 10 a couple pages later. No idea how much time's going by. She's having a baby. A page later, she has the baby. This passage of time was very confusing to me.
I didn't even know it was her baby. And if I didn't have mom friends who called their children like little people or something, I would have no clue that that was her child.
Yeah.
I can tell you that right now.
And then I don't think that this is a complete negative, but reading about how the author had written 2 previous novels for adults, suddenly it was the veil's lifted. I see so much more clearly because this book does not have like the same type of tone as the other ones. And I don't think that's inherently a bad thing, but the author has much more of a almost like a lyrical style of writing.
Well, it's more fluid.
Exactly.
Yeah, which makes sense. And once again, we are encountering another preface saying, just so you know, there was no written language, so suspend your disbelief. And I'm thinking, I was going to do that anyways.
I'm reading a diary.
I'm pretty sure that none of these people kept a diary like this.
Exactly.
So once again, I was disappointed. And I'm just, you know what it is? It's because I feel like we've done these episodes in publishing order. Mm-hmm. And on the backside, now it's, hey, we should have like all the indigenous people and stories and blah, blah, blah showing up. And it's a good thing, but I would have preferred it to be more interspersed.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about, I don't want to say like, oh, there's so many similarities, but there are quite a few similarities. I don't know. It's just within development and all this other kind of stuff, like in ritual and living with nature, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, because, but here's another thing.
You don't want it to get too repetitive.
Well, another thing too is like, let's think about it. We have Weetamoo, again, indigenous person. How do they go and encounter the colonizer?
Yeah.
Lady Planetqua, where we do not have her encountering the colonizer, but because we're dealing with somebody where we do not have that much written history of her, we have to go and talk about the history of her people. And of course,
the colonizing shows up.
And then we go and we have, yeah, and now Anacona, and the final part of the book is, again, the colonizer showing up. And we're not saying this in a way of like a, oh no, like how could you go and talk about white people being like terrible and part of colonial process? Like, that's not what we're saying here. We're saying that it's kind of shitty when all the indigenous people put as a bit of a footnote as the series is starting to come towards its own end.
Yeah, as opposed to being more prominent and up front and center.
Our first woman of color is Nzinga. Again, a story where colonialism
is showing up
and the transatlantic slave trade. We have Kaiulani, which again, imperialism. Yeah. And another like form of colonialism. Lady of Chiaoku, not as much, but again, colonialism and invasion, another theme topic.
Yeah.
And then Sondok, not so much, which is like a nice little brief.
I mean, even if there is the vizier person from China rolling up, that's not the main conflict in that time period too.
No.
Which is nice.
And then we have Jahanara, where again, we have East India. So this is right before. Or we're about to go and get into like the high point of British colonial expansion in India, but again.
But yeah, but she's got to be wearing her Elizabeth I pendant being like, this lady's so cool.
Absolutely love her. Amazing. And then nobody until we get to, again, Weetamoo, and then Lady Planek, Kazunomiya, again, Americans.
Showing up.
Exactly. Oh, well, it shows like how shitty history is.
Well, and how repetitive it is. But then also, this is totally like a, just a you and me whining about the fact that we undertook this project.
Mm-hmm.
And we're obviously aware of these things happening throughout history. But I think when you're having to do in-depth research, mm-hmm. and then sharing it back and forth, it's almost, here we are again, folks.
Yeah.
So if you think these episodes are repetitive, you cannot blame us. We're like the ghost of Christmas past. These are the shadows that they are, that they are. Do not blame me.
Pretty much.
Besides, you know, history being a wheel over and over again, any other thoughts regarding this book?
I appreciated that periods were happening within like the first five pages. We've talked about this quite a bit.
We just get excited about menstruation.
Well, but then we have a critique. I'm not looking for anything explicit, but like this woman was married and had a child. When I was 12, 13, I read books where I knew that these characters were having sex. Did his parrot go and like carry the baby over and down? No, did not. Let us not go and patronize young girls and women who are the target audience who know certain things.
Fair. But then again, they're also trying to make sure that they're not getting their book banned.
I mean, fair enough, especially considering that this is also Scholastic as well.
And also, where else are you going to find anything written about Anacona? Let me tell you, it's hard.
I know. You and I...
I will tell you from the fact that when I was trying to research this, it's very difficult. So, I enjoyed it. You know what it was? It's that whole thing of you're going into a reading, you're like, I know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I know Christopher Columbus's terribleness is just going to show up here. How is it going to show up? Mm-hmm. How much are we going to get into this?
Mm-hmm.
It almost revved up where they show up and then she's like, we're going to take a stand. We're going to be warriors. And then next thing I know, it's like, I guess we'll just go collect gold for them. And I'm like, well, what happened? Like,
yeah.
It happened very, very quickly. And I feel like this book, because of how it's very fluid in its writing, it demands you to read slow. So if you're a fast reader, which I tend to be a fast reader, so sometimes I kind of skim a little. That's where I think it begs a slow read.
I mean, I had
think
to
this
go
is good for a slow read.
I had to go and slow down. Suddenly, I realized I had no idea what the passage of time was happening here. Like time, we already know that time is a lie and everything. But this book really makes it clear.
This book really messed with it.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Well, and then also plenty of alluding to the horrors that will come. I was just like, oh no. I was like, please don't do this.
That's like, I mean, we have a bit of, not like a hard rule, but a bit of a soft rule not to go and do that much reading about the person who's not your focus.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just sitting here being, let me guess, tightening around my throat, feeling like I was being geared. I'm like, did she get hanged or something? And then first line on the freaking Wikipedia page. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I was like, thank you.
Thank you. Like, I'm glad that this book is, so let's just lean into this hardcore.
Yeah. It's called foreshadowing. I was like, you do that much.
You know, one thing though I do want to go and critique is that this is another book where again we go and we have indigenous people being super focused on dreams and having like prophetic visions.
Yeah.
Which I'm not saying like inherently a bad thing, but I do think that it goes and it says something that, you know, we don't have Marie Antoinette going and having a nightmare about things going to crap. Or, you know, Cleopatra also does not feel like these type of premonition-y
things.
Like this whole thing of like being super in touch of like things beyond yourself, we have to go and frame it as just spooky thing that only indigenous people are really tapped in because they're so special and magical.
Yeah, it's like shamanism and stuff like that, where it's interesting because it's the person that actually comes closest, in my opinion, to showcasing that level of vigor with their spiritual beliefs encapsulating their life is that Isabel book.
Yeah.
So I think that's where, yeah, you're right. There is that element missing in a lot of the people's books where, yeah, not foreshadowing about what will come to be.
But again, thank God this doesn't happen in the Nzinga book, the magic Negro, the magic like indigenous person who will predict the future, etc.
Yeah.
Even in having them like their own personal context, it is something where I'm like, this seems to be a recurring thing that happens only in select women's stories. I wonder why. What do they have in common?
Well, you know? I mean, there is something about, you know, certain shamanistic practices of, they would burn things and then they would have visions and stuff because of, you know.
But this is not the context of this book.
But that's not the context in which this is happening. It's more like just her as a person being like, I have vibes.
Yeah.
It's not like she's a shaman who's partaking in shamanistic rituals.
Yeah, this isn't like Sondok going and having the ceremony for her mother and trying to go and figure out like what to do.
To find the actual path.
Yeah. And so it's just,
and she's not even the one having the vision. It's the shaman person who is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's just like, that's just another thing that I picked up in this book where I was,
It's almost like a check. It's like a bingo card. Does your indigenous person have visions? Check.
Does your indigenous person absolutely love nature?
Check.
Does your indigenous person have to go and be completely marginalized fundamentally within their own narrative because we need to go and, of course, incorporate enough white people so that we go and make our reader go and feel less alienated?
Check.
Exactly.
Okay. Any more thoughts on the book?
I really like the color.
Oh, the lovely lime greeny color.
Oh, yeah. This is actually, to me, along with the Sondok book, the prettiest of the books.
Yeah, I know. It's very beautiful, very vibrant.
Yeah.
So, since this is my last book episode.
Oh, my God.
Tears, tears, tears. And it's another figure from history whose history has passed through multiple layers of telling. I wanted to reflect and engage in the deeper concept of history itself.
Oh, God. We're getting really meta, aren't we?
Oh, yeah, we are. So we've talked a lot about this over the course of making the podcast. You know, what is history? Who's it for? Who writes it? Who's included? who's excluded. Most people believe that history is a collection of facts from the past. This is reinforced in textbooks used in teaching it. They're written as though they're a collection of info. In fact, history is more about making arguments about what happened in the past based on what people recorded in documents, artifacts, oral traditions at the time. Historians often disagree over what are the facts as well as how they should be interpreted. The problem is complicated for major events that produce winners and losers. We're more likely to have sources written by winners designed to show why they are heroic in their victories or how the losers deserve to be triumphed over. Mm-hmm. You know this. I know this.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of our listeners know this. However, I think there is something about anytime we're engaging, even if it is in for funsies history, actually thinking about the practice itself, because even while we're doing it, we are creating history.
Yeah.
So that being said, in one book, authors write, the Caribs were a fierce, warlike people who lived on the islands of the Eastern Caribbean. The most ferocious Caribs were found on the island of Dominica. Some explorers believe they were cannibals. Europeans on nearby islands lived in great fear of their attacks. Not until many Caribs had been killed by the English in 1638 did the settlers feel secure. This is actually from a history textbook that I had since a child, like a big cursory one.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see the problem with it. There's no analysis in this passage. The author is simply telling a story based upon the European versions of what happened. There's no explanation of why they were fierce, the Caribs, or where the ideal of cannibalism even comes from. Many individuals believe that history is about telling stories, but most historians will want to answer questions like, why did this rumor of cannibalism start? Why were the Caribs perceived to be so fierce? Would having been invaded do anything with that?
Mm-hmm.
So to answer these questions, historians turn to primary sources, firsthand accounts of what happened at the time. The first mention of Carib comes from the Diario of Columbus's first voyage. The manuscript that has survived is a transcription written by Bartolomé de las Casas. Historians use these sources to make arguments, which could be refuted by different interpretations of the same evidence or discovery of new sources. So, for example, James Michener in 1988 used the notion of peaceful Arawaks
Tainos
and warlike cannibal Caribs as a literary device to portray a battle between good and evil in the West Indies. In addition, some historians have suggested the reason Bahama Archipelago was first settled was because people were fleeing the Carib cannibals who were supposedly attacking the islands of the Greater Antilles. According to legend, the Caribs ate the men, married the women, and ideally, under each one of these thesis statements, each of these arguments is about why the Caribs were perceived this way, but there's no concrete evidence pointing in that direction. So over and over again, we get these narratives being cycled and cycled, but nobody's actually pausing to say, wait, where are we getting this from?
How do we go and get into this idea that Cleopatra was like the hoe of the Nile when really it was Julius Caesar and Mark Antony who are the hoes of the Tiber?
Well, Mark Antony was definitely a big sleut.
Yes.
So to become a critical reader and to empower yourself to own your own history, really think carefully about whether the evidence the author provides does in fact support the thesis. When a history book provides only conclusions and not much evidence, you want to explore other historians or try to read additional primary sources. With a very real caveat, if one people group is writing about the other and the other doesn't know what we're going to be writing, how can there be a both sides argument made? One way to think about primary sources is to ask these questions. When was the source written? Who is the intended audience? What are the similarities? What are the differences? What pieces of information will support your argument? And what information of the source is totally irrelevant to the argument you're trying to make? All forms of communication have to be interpreted in context. How do people who don't understand one another's language communicate? How much credibility should there be given to the written language in which encounters are recorded? Can we record the biases of people who wrote the story and juxtapose those biases with the people they encountered? Can we read between the lines? So what do we know about the native peoples of the West Indies is from what we learn from early Spanish explorers. We do know in some places they use the word
Tainao
when greeting the Spanish. The word is translated to noble or good. It's the root of the word in
Tainao,
which was used in reference to the noble or elite class of the society.
Tainos
has replaced the earlier term Arawak as the most commonly used name to identify the pre-Columbian inhabitants of central Caribbean islands just before and at the time of European contact. To date, most of what has been written about the
Tainos
is drawn upon the written record left by the Spanish. However, because the chronicles were written to serve political objectives, be they for or against native people,
because the chroniclers themselves had limited their abilities to understand a non-Western culture, these documents are rife with errors and misinformation. The uncritical use of the historical record has hampered efforts to understand the native West Indian societies. Although we continue to speak of the Tainau as a single unified group, there were regional differences in language and culture. When Columbus landed in Guahani in 1492, he was met by a people whose simple dress and material technology belied their social and political complexity. Theirs was a vibrant culture in the process of filling up the northern and western Lucien Islands. At the same time, they were competing among themselves for political and economic control of the central islands. Had the Spanish never arrived, the Lucien
Tainaus
may have soon been subject to from the classic
Tainaus
on Hispaniola, who are already establishing bases or outposts in the Turks and Caicos and Greater Iguana by the middle of the 13th century.
When we go and we talk about indigenous people pre-contact, it's this idea of like, oh, like they were all just chilling there. And it's, you know, just going about their days. Like, no, like they had their own political and economic strifes. They had their back and forth of each other. And it's not to go and say it's, oh, because they were like savage and they didn't have a system or anything.
No,
like that.
The
it's
same
like
way that European countries were bashing and fighting each other. They were doing the same thing.
But also it's like they weren't just going and waiting for the colonial system to go and show up. They were their own societies and they were their own cultures, right? They weren't stagnant in this really idealized idea sometimes. Either it's like, you know, you have the indigenous savage or the peaceful indigenous person who never did
like
anything.
That guy, yeah, like how that guy was saying, like there's two groups of them, the fierce cannibal ones and then there's like the peaceful ones. No, these alleged quote-unquote peaceful ones, they were slowly going island to island and taking over, but instead their legacy is remembered as the first native peoples to challenge Columbus and the first to be extinguished.
Of course.
So another aspect to this story that is equally inaccurate is the portrayal of the native people who met Columbus. Much of the history of these people is based on what Columbus wrote about them. Imagine if someone who didn't understand your language or culture, who's never met you, but knew their ways were superior to yours, wrote about you. And 500 years later, everybody's still believing them.
Of course.
Also remember when describing the New World, Columbus was trying to convince Queen Isabella and King Fernando that these lands were in such abundance that the sovereign should underwrite the cost of their exploration and colonization. He was saying, this place is amazing. It has all this great stuff. Please send money.
Yeah, because this is also happening during 1492, which was Isabella's year from hell.
Well, her year where she was like wreaking hell on everybody.
Actually, yeah, more of a fair assessment.
Yeah, Isabella was having a great year in her estimation.
Ah, yeah, she
everybody else was just like, this is a terrible year. So Columbus gave new names to many of the places he landed. For example, the Lucien Islanders called the island where he landed Guahani, but Columbus called it San Salvador, which translates to Holy Savior. To make matters worse, Columbus asserted that the native peoples owed allegiance to the Spanish monarchs. So imagine how you would react today if a foreign power from across the ocean landed on your shore, gave your country a new name, and demanded we change our system of government.
I mean,
this is where it's like, anytime we're telling these narratives, pause and reflect and put yourself in the shoes of the other person.
Yeah.
So the origin of the Lucien
Tainaus
can be traced back to the banks of the Orinoco River in Venezuela. As early as 2100 BC, villages of horticulturalists who used pottery vessels to cook their food had been established along the middle Orinoco. During the ensuing two millennia, their population increased in numbers and they expanded down the river outward towards the tributaries on the coast of Venezuela, to the Guineas and Trinidad. Their movements are easily traced because of the pottery they manufactured is so distinctive. Given the modern barren landscape of the Lucien Islands, it's often asked why anyone would leave the fertile valleys of the Greater Antilles to settle in this island chain. The answer is that although the Lucien Islands today are covered in low scrub vegetation and there's a lack of fresh water, these conditions were not the norm 500 years ago. In fact, the islands would have been quite attractive to small groups of horticulturalists who farmed the loamy soil and relied on the sea for fish and transport.
When we think about the colonial project, the ecological devastation from stripping the land of resources and overfishing, overhunting,
well,
agriculture.
And clear cutting mm-hmm. massive amounts of forests so that they can make these uber plantations. So when we think of all the islands. Where you go, that's not at all how it would have been when these people were living and thriving in their lives. So,
because, mm-hmm. yeah, there's no need for mass, large scale agriculture like that.
No. In 1871, the American ethnologist Daniel Britton suggested that these people should be called Island Arawaks. After researching the native West Indian words recorded by the Spanish, Britton recognized that
Tainos
spoke a language that belonged to the Arawakan family of languages common in South America. Because he understood these people were different from mainland Arawaks, he included the prefix island in his designation. Yet over the years, the prefix was dropped for simplicity, but by the mid-1980s, archaeologists have realized using the name Arawak without the island had blurred the distinction between South American and Western Indian natives, so they just adopted the term
Tainau.
But it's still that idea of the name that we've put on these people.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't necessarily even what they would have called themselves.
Yeah, it's like people going using like Iroquois instead of Haudenosaunee.
Yeah. Of course, the West Indian natives had many regional names for themselves, and the Spanish recorded some of these. They called the islands to the north Hispaniola, Las Islas de la Lucianos. And so we call the native people of the Bahama Archipelago the Lucians, or more accurately, the Lucian
Tainos.
The Luceo ultimately came from the words Lu, which mean tribe or people, and Cari, which translates to island. So Lucian
Tainos
are good island people. Our word K, or Ki, comes from another
Tainau
word for small island. Keo and the word Kekeo means outer island or faraway island. This is something that was really, really neat when I was doing this reading, is there are so many words that I attributed to being Spanish words, whatever. They're totally not. They are indigenous words from the people of these islands. So it's really, really cool in that way.
I love that.
I'll share with you some words. Not right now, but along the
way.
The Dominican friar Bartolomé de las Casas described several distinct cultural groups in the greater Antilles in the early 16th century. Among these were the Siboney of central Cuba, who Las Casas indicated were being enslaved by Hispaniolan
Tainos,
who had settled in the island. The word Ciba translates as stony or rocky in this context, and it refers to the topography of central Cuba. In the past, archaeologists have mistakenly used Siboney to refer to the pre-Tainau Archaic Age peoples of Cuba. The Archaic Age circa 5000 BC to 580 people supposedly did not make pottery or practice agriculture. Yet Las Casas was clear in stating that the Siboney were culturally very similar to the Lucianos, who are ceramic-producing farmers. The last major group of the West Indies is the Caribs. These are the people that Columbus described as cannibals, keeping in mind that cannibals were allowed by Queen Isabel to be taken as slaves.
I'm pretty sure that Carib is where we get Caribbean or Caribbean, right?
Yes.
I've always wondered, where did we get... Where did that come from? And the more you know.
There's like, the more you know, da-na-na-na, is like the underscoring theme song of you and me throughout this entire project.
Oh, yeah.
So practically, this designation was used as a justification for the mistreatment of native populations.
The Tainau
had cannibals, Carib, in their mythology, but they had never encountered any in person. In the
Tainau
language, Carib translates as any strong or brave person. As far as archaeologists are concerned, the island Caribs were Arawakan-speaking peoples who came from South America, occupied windward islands of the Lesser Antilles later in the pre-Columbian period, and survived well into historic times. They did not practice cannibalism.
I mean, but that's also when we were talking about in the previous episode too, this whole thing of the Mayas and the Aztecs, human sacrifice.
To what extent? Well, and also,
what does that actually mean?
How does it actually look? Not to say that there wasn't elements of human sacrifice practice, but it's more like distinctly blanketing a whole island population and saying, because they're engaging in what we've deemed to be barbaric practices, therefore we're allowed to practice barbarism on them
of
and
course.
Enslave them.
Yep.
So the
Tainos
were an agricultural people. We estimate that they cultivated or managed more than 80 different plants that provided food and medicine for ailments, fibers for nets, ropes, and hammocks. While the main food crops in Europe were cereal grains, the people of the West Indies had root crops. European gardens involved plow agriculture, where plants were cultivated in neat rows. Fields were fertilized with manure from domesticated animals or allowed fallow for a few years in the process of crop rotation. In contrast,
Tainau
fields must have appeared messy and disorganized. This Spanish encountered several types of gardens. First, various plants and herbs requiring special care or immediate use were planted around the house in what we would call a house garden. These were precursors to our modern herb and flower gardens, which mainly serve aesthetic purposes for us. In contrast, house gardens contain very useful species. Their staple crop was yucca, today known as manioc. The yucca was processed into kvass bread called kvassi. According to mythology, it was the cultural hero Diman and his brothers who stole manioc from the high god Ya and brought it to the Tainau people. The story mirrors other cultures' myths where human wrests their means of subsistence from supernatural beings.
Prometheus going and taking fire down to the humans.
Yeah, over and over again, it's the same thing of, I took this from the gods and I gave it to the people so we could live. Same with corn, like the maize for the Maya people, things like that.
That just makes me go and think about this offhand comment that one of my art teachers made that kind of blew my mind, which is that if you go and you look at pottery around the world, it's always generally in the same shape. Doesn't matter across difference. Human beings and our capacity to go and develop tools, find our needs, and also create actually unites us more than those differences, but we can't actually go and see that.
Yeah, very much so. So this myth was referenced and recreated when Tainau buried stone carvings of Yuko, literally the giver of manioc, into agricultural fields. These stones were triangular and resembled a sprouting tuber. The god image on the three-pointed stone often has an open mouth, which eats the soil to make room for the tubers to grow. Yukao was the lord of yucca, the male god of fertility. So sort of similar to the Maya, where you were prescribed more than just one role. The Spanish immediately recognized the usefulness of manioc. The kvass bread could be stored for long periods, and it came to replace the hardtack as a staple for expeditions throughout Americas. Villages were forced to pay tribute with kvass bread, and villages, especially in the eastern Hispaniola, were responsible for provisioning Spanish ships. By providing kvass bread, maybe the Tainos hoped that they would just take the bread and leave. Which is what most people would do when you go from place to place. Is, hi, I showed up. I want my provisions. Thank you very much. I will go.
Mm-hmm.
That did not happen.
No, this is abuse of a toxic relationship. If you give me this one thing, I'll leave you alone, baby. It's a lie.
It's a lie.
It's always been a lie.
Spanish records indicate that Lucien Tainaus cultivated as many 50 plants, including varieties of sweet and bitter manioc, sweet potatoes, cocoa, yams, beans, gourds, chili peppers, corn, cotton, tobacco, bixa, genep, ground nuts, guava, papaya. The carbonized remains of corn, chili pepper, palm fruit, unidentified tubers, probably manioc, sweet potato, and gourds are among the plants that remained identified in West Indian archaeological sites. At least half of the Lucien diet came from plant food. Manioc was the staple, followed by sweet potato. Corn was cultivated, but was apparently of secondary importance. The other half of the diet came from creatures of the land and sea. Very few land animals that were available, iguana, crab, cat-sized rodents called a jutia, were highly prized but only available in limited quantities. The major source of animal protein came from coastal marine environment. Marine turtles, monk seals were available seasonally, but the main foods were fishes and mollusks who fed in grass flat patch reef habitats between the reef barrier and the beach. Parrotfish, grouper, snapper, bonefish, conch, urchins, clams. Fish were captured with nets, baskets, spears, bows, arrows. The latter involved building check dams across mouths of tidal creeks, so the fish would come in at high tide, but then they couldn't escape when the tide changed. Meat and fish were grilled with leftovers added to the pepper pot. When you consider the number of ways the Lucien Tainaus could satisfy their hunger, the islands are noteworthy for an abundance of options. It's difficult to imagine anyone ever went hungry. So this actually is interesting, connecting back to the whole thing of hunter-gatherer, blah, 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 that we had talked about with the Maya.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it, where it's, until the 1970s, notions of progressive cultural evolution viewed modern society as the pinnacle of social development. People of the past must have lived deprived lives and cultures that survived by hunting and gathering were viewed as barely managing to survive. Civilization was only possible with the development of agriculture, which served as the foundation of the world's great civilizations. Then came along Marshall Shalins in 1970, who was one of the first to actually calculate the amount of time hunter-gatherers spent obtaining food. They actually worked less hard to meet their needs than most of us do today. For this reason, he called them the original affluent society.
I mean, if somebody were to go and ask me what type of society I would like to be in or see our food system be, hunter-gatherer sounds great to me personally. I'll have my little garden in the backyard, have a couple like community plots. We don't need food the way that we have, and the reason why we have food the way that we have right now too is because corporations need to make money. Yeah. That's why everything has freaking corn syrup in it.
Well, and also this way too, where before we judge at the food, let us consider the lowly mollusk. The modern view of eating mollusks is skewed by our notion of superiority over the past. But think about it this way. Here in North America, most people view a snail as a garden pest. But in France, it's escargot. Mm-hmm. Digging clams in the eastern shore and catching scallops are popular family activities, but most people don't do these to feed their families. So should we believe that our lifestyle is so different from those who lived in the past? So when we think about, oh, they ate mollusks, they ate these things, not all the time. We don't know. Maybe it was a delicacy, or maybe it was just a, this is a fun thing we're doing this afternoon. But we build up whole narratives about how people live their everyday lives based off of just, well, we found these shells, therefore they must have totally subsided off of these shells. No.
No.
Tainos
lived in large multifamily houses. In Hispaniola, there were two types of houses, the regular bijo and the round to oval cane, which had a high-pitched colonial thatched roof. Although this is probably an exaggeration, the early 16th century Spanish chronicler Bartolomé de las Casas reported that some houses were occupied by 40 to 60 heads of household, so roughly 250 women, men, and children. Households were formed around groups of related females, grandmother, mother, sisters, and daughters living together and cooperating in farming, child rearing, food preparation, and craft production. Men, by virtue of their absence of communities during long-distance trade or warfare, were peripheral to the household. The importance of the females as the foundation of society was expressed by tracing descent through the female line with a mythical female ancestress. This matrilineal society organization is common throughout the world.
What a concept.
I know. And I think that's
men at the periphery. What a concept.
And I think this is the other thing too, where removing that lens of modern and Western, those two things are the best and or the only way to be. Is no, there are other ways of being. Mm-hmm. Other societies currently right here, right now, they still can do this. They still are doing this. Mm-hmm. And also the idea of, oh, well, it's not modern and progressive. Well, yeah. Actually, it is.
Exactly.
In the Greater Antilles, a slightly different type of community plan predominates. Here, the houses are arranged around central plazas. The plazas were used for public displays, ritual dancing, recording astronomical events, and the
Tainao
version of the ball game. The chief's house, typically located at one end of the plaza, stored the village idols and spirits representations called quimes. The Parthenon of Quimes was divided by gender and culture / non-cultural. There are principal male and female spirits of fruitfulness, the giver of manic, Abreta, the mother goddess. They were both attended by the twin spirits, Makarit Gaba, the lord of the dead, and Gabanex, the mistress of the hurricane, ruled the anti-culture world. They were attended by two sets of twins. The Quimes played an active role in the affairs of the humans, and they served to distinguish between what was human, cultural, pleasing, which was non-human, anti-cultural, and foul. But as exemplified, the twins,
Tainos,
recognized the spirits of the world could simultaneously have positive and negative characteristics. For example, rains are good when they arrive right on time and the right quality, but they can also devastate your land when the timing is wrong or too much rain falls. Viewed their world in delicate balance, and they attended to both spirits to maintain this balance. So they recognize there's good and there's bad, but you need both.
What a healthy, emotionally balanced concept and way to go and approach your life. I need the bad, so the good is good. But at the same time, if things are always good, I'm never able to go and fully appreciate it.
Exactly.
And it's all about context.
Yes. By the time the Europeans arrived,
Tainos
society had two main divisions. The rulers of the community were the noble class called the In
Tainos,
which include chiefs, shamans, and other elites who held positions of authority. Chiefs called caciques ruled at several different levels, from paramount caciques that ruled large regions to district leaders who were allied to paramount, headman, clan lords who ruled at the village level. So it's a structure like that. Between the caciques of all levels, alliances were formed through marriage. Supporting the rulers were a large number of commoners. Blood and marriage kinship were threads that bound commoners to caciques. There is also a level below the commoner class, which the Spanish described as a class of servants. Anacona was born in Yaguana, the capital of Little Spain, in approximately 1474. Her name is derived from the words meaning Ana, meaning flower, and Coana, meaning gold or golden. Anacona's brother, Bihecho, was a local chieftain. He extended his rule in 1475 to include include all the territories west of Ixara. The chiefdoms of Hispaniola, like political units employed by the inhabitants. At the time of contact, the island was divided into five chiefdoms, each headed by one of those paramount chiefs, below them the lessers. So the Jagra is where Anacona was from. It spanned the entire southwest of the island of Hispaniola. So what is today Haiti and Dominican? Mm-hmm. That's Hispaniola.
I did know that. For the longest time. Oh yeah, like Hispaniola. I'm like, what is this island?
I know. You're like Googling, like, where is Hispaniola?
And then they're like Haiti
or Dominican would show up. And I'm like, I asked for Hispaniola.
What are you talking about?
Imagine the island, the whole island in your mind.
There's actually a really helpful map in the back of the book. Let's just go to the back of the book.
The helpful map at the back of the book. Map of the book.
Back of the book.
So this is also interesting too, I also read. Mm-hmm. In terms of changing your perspective, we as Westerners, because of using compasses, we orient ourselves north.
Yeah.
These people oriented themselves east.
Makes sense.
First, because of where the sun would rise. So looking at the map from her perspective, she's actually on the quote-unquote top
of the island.
Of the island.
Huh.
But according to us, she's on the southwest side.
Yes.
Of the island. That's where she was. And then what her brother did was he married her to Kaunabo, the cacique of Mangua. And that is in the top middle part of the island.
Well, and then that makes sense, one, with the whole birds thing. Because I'm sitting here being like, I am not overly familiar with the geography of the area.
I know. Well, and it made it seem like because he was so far away.
And he was on the boat,
and
too,
she had to take a
well.
Boat. I was just, is he on a different island? No, he's on a different part of the island. So he was actually in the biggest part. There's land on either side kind of thing. But this territory where he was is in present-day Dominican Republic. So they were pretty far apart from each other when she had to travel over there. So where he was from, her husband, that was the principal cacique of the island and represented as the rock. The term Mangua means first stone or the only stone. The principal mother goddess of the chiefdom was Apito, which means mother of stone. When Columbus set foot on the island he called San Salvador, young men carrying spears who were there to defend their village met him. Other encounters between the Spanish and
Tainos
also point to the importance of warfare in society. For instance, when he embarked on a quest of central Hispaniola in 1494, he was challenged by an army of up to 15,000 warriors, although this might have been an exaggeration on his part. So the cacique...
Columbus exaggerating? Perish the thought.
I know. Oh, man.
Christopher Columbus has never told a lie in his life. I have never done anything wrong in my life. I know this, and I believe you. We do not believe him.
Actual right there footage of Columbus talking and Fernando being like, I know this and I believe you. Get out of here, Fernando. So the cacique Caobao, Anacona's husband, was the first to resist Spanish occupation. The fort that Christopher Columbus established, La Navidad, was destroyed by him. And he also attempted to sack the Fortaleza de la Santo Tomas, but it was captured by the Spanish forces led by Alonso de Oja. But instead of being condemned to death, he was sent to Spain to be paraded in front of the royal court, but he died on the voyage. Shortly after the Spanish arrested Caobo, Bartholomew Columbus, the brother of Christopher Columbus, was passing by the Niba River, which formed the boundary between the regions of Ixara and Mangua. Here he encountered an army from Ixara, so Anacona's original homeland, that was probably in the area to co-opt villages that had previously been allied with the deposed chief. When her husband was captured, Anacona returned home and served as an advisor to Bocheo. In 1498, Bocheo was confronted by Bartholomew Columbus, who arrived with his troops to subdue him and conquer the territory. The purpose of the Spaniards in doing so was to acquire gold. With his power weakened, Bocheo, advised by Anacona, decided to recognize the sovereignty of the Catholic monarchs. Instead of fighting, he committed himself to paying tribute levied by the Spaniards with products like cotton, bread, corn, and fish. After his death, Anacona ruled. Although the Europeans had been killing
the Tainao
for years, Anacona realized her people could not compete on military footing and established a different policy to that of her husband and brother, an outward appearance of appeasement and integration. Mm-hmm. Her approach would be familiar to royalty around the world, flattery and intermarriage. Each time a European dignitary, usually Columbus's brother, came to visit, she would stop by the storehouses to shower them with gifts, but despite goodwill actions, this wasn't buying her or her people any more time. In the fall of 1503, Governor Nicholas Ovando and his party of 300 traveled on foot to Exara. They were received in a lavish ceremony by Anacona and her nobles and several chiefs. When they presented the reception as a welcome gesture, the Spanish saw it as being an elaborate distraction. So Ovando's party was under the impression that Anacona and the chiefs were planning an insurrection.
Let's be honest, those people probably showed up with the plan regardless. Like, they were being weird. Yeah, that's just a complete bullshit cover.
They're calling self-defense after they've already done the deed, let's be honest. Ovando lured the chiefs into a caney, so a large hut, for a Spanish tournament, and then gave the signal for the Spanish to seize and bind them. They were then burned in that caney while
Tainos
of lower rank were slaughtered outside and Anacona was hanged. Some versions mention that the colonists offered her clemency if she became a concubine, an offer which she refused. While that wouldn't be all unlikely, there's no shortage of evidence of colonists committing similar atrocities. We just don't know. Either way, she was brutally murdered around the age of 30. So within a generation of the Spanish arriving, the native peoples of the Lusitan Islands were more or less extinct. In 1513, Juan Ponce de Leon sailed through the Lusitan Islands on his way to Florida. He reported that he encountered only one inhabitant, an old native man still living in Turks and Caicos Islands. The other expeditions that followed, including two in 1520, failed to encounter any native people on these islands. The fate of the Lusitan
Tainos
can be traced to the mines of Hispaniola and the pearl beds of Cubago Islands off of the coast of Venezuela. By 1509, the Spanish governor, Santo Domingo, had convinced King Ferdinand there was a critical shortage of labor in Hispaniola. In response, the king ordered all the peoples from the neighboring islands to relocate to Hispaniola. A slaving consortium soon formed at the Concepción de la Vega, although documents in the archives of Seville suggest that the practice of enslaving the people had begun much earlier. The contact period, Spanish chronicler Peter Martyr de Ancora reported that 40,000 Lusitans were brought to Hispaniola. The total population of the islands was probably twice that number when children, old people, and others who died are included. A total population of 40 to 80,000 of Lusitans is consistent with archaeological deposits in these islands. It's surprising how much we do know about the
Tainos,
considering that by 1524, they no longer existed as a separate population group. They left a legacy of crops and cultural items that are enjoyed today. Even through the eyes of the Spanish, part of this inner life of this lost culture was captured and can be imagined even a few hundred years later. We're constrained by the fact that the
Tainos
did not have a written language, which means we have to rely on Spanish chroniclers for the words that have importance and meanings. They're translations that probably cannot capture the meanings that were understood by native speakers. When the Spanish invaded the Americas, they literally landed in, quote-unquote, their new world. Like Dorothy and Oz, exotic and unknown people and plants and animals surrounding them. They probably struggled to find the words to describe them. As with all languages, when an object or an idea is new, the native term is frequently adopted. Luis Hernandez Aquino scoured more than 150 sources dealing with the initial contact period in the West Indies and compiled a dictionary of
Tainos
words. The second edition of his Dictionary of Indigenous Words was published in 1977. The book is a fascinating portal into the world of the
Tainos.
As might be expected, most of the words are for names of people, places, animals. Clearly, the dictionary is biased towards people and things that Spanish people deemed worthy of mention. Although the dictionary focuses on Puerto Rico, many of the words can be applied to plants and animals across the Caribbean. Reconstructing the behaviors of people who lived in the past requires a series of complicated and logical interference. On one hand, we often possess written descriptions of activities were practiced when Europeans arrived on the scene, along with names of particular animals of importance to those making the records. On the other hand, we have archaeological materials that include tools that have been preserved, bones of animals that would have survived hundreds of years, and there are numerous problems with assigning a particular use to an object, which often requires analysis as well as useware evidence. So you can find the thing, but you don't necessarily know what it actually was used for, how it was used, and what was the significance. Sort of that whole thing with the bone calendar.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking.
And how they were trying to puzzle, like, why would there be these 30 notches marked into it? Like, what does this mean? What could it be used for? What type of tool? And blah, blah, blah. And I think it was like a woman archaeologist who said, well, it's probably used for counting out your menstruation cycle. Because it's usually a 30-day thing. But it's a bunch of dude archaeologists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's change your perspective.
Yeah.
Put yourself in the position of who could have been using this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So at the time of the Columbus quincentennial, the consensus among scholars was that native peoples were extinct. The Greater Antilles had been decimated with harsh treatment and the introduction of European diseases, and they had no immunities in the first decades of the 16th century, and neighboring peoples like the Lusitanos were rounded up and enslaved as labor in the gold mines of Hispaniola and the pearl fishing industry of the Southern Caribbean. In the Lesser Antilles, the island Caribs managed to hold off Europeans' efforts to colonize these islands for almost 200 years. They did so by being more mobile, more bellicose in their response to the British and French incursions, and through brilliant political strategy of pitting one European power against each other. St. Lucia, for example, shifted between French and British sovereignty 17 times during the early colonial period.
If you can go and get your bully to go and punch the other person who wants to bully you, I mean, that's just a masterclass.
Yeah. But when the British and French ceased fighting among themselves, their one enemy became the island Caribs. And in 1797, the last remaining Caribs were captured, brought to St. Vincent, and deported. The descendants of the island Carib peoples living on the Mosquito coast of Central America are now known as the Garfuna. By the beginning of the 18th century, it was believed that all native peoples had been exterminated. Europeans had succeeded in suppressing native lifeways, erasing their cultures within several generations. However, it's not true that these societies left no imprint on the subsequent historical developments on the islands. It's possible that some groups survived as refugees in remote locations in the way that slaves escaped and created maroon societies throughout the Caribbean. As late as the 19th century, there were reports in Cuba of wild Indians raiding haciendas. Well into the 16th century, most marriages in the Spanish islands, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico, were recorded between Spanish men and
Taino
women. Kathleen Deegan, in her studies of Spanish colonial enterprise, has documented the influence of
Taino
women on the development of Criollo culture in the islands, blending Spanish and native ways of life. Caribbean culinary practices, fishing techniques, pottery vessels, housing, land use, a wide variety of words, barbecue, canoe, guava, hammock, hurricane, marine, maroon, potato, tobacco have survived into the present.
I'm so grateful for the hammock.
I know. And the barbecue.
And like, the barbecue.
Barbecue, hammock, guava, a canoe. I'm all there. Thank you. There's much more than that, by the way.
Oh, of course.
That
of
was
course.
Just like a short list of the ones that really resonated with me like, that I was like, I labored on the false impression that they were the anglicized version of a Spanish word or something.
But now also, though, because we're going into really cold weather now, I really could go for lying in a hammock with some guava and some barbecue, just chilling, you know?
Oh, cue the music. So we also need to recognize that the governments of many of the newly independent regions in the Caribbean also failed to recognize their native history. For many of them, the main historical interest was their African heritage because the native people supposedly had contributed little to their modern legacy. A meeting with government representatives in 1989, a researcher was told, "The Indian stuff is fine, but what about our heritage?" Thankfully, now things are changing. In 2018, an ancient tooth has proven that
Taino
Indigenous Americans are not extinct as long believed.
Hey.
Have living descendants in the Caribbean today. Researchers made the discovery when they used a 1,000-year-old tooth to sequence the first completed ancient human genome in the Caribbean. The tooth was found in the cave on the island of Ithura in the Bahamas, and it belonged to a woman who lived at least 500 years before Christopher Columbus set foot in the region. The lead author, Elsky Wilterslev, who is posts at the University of Cambridge and University of Copenhagen, said in a statement, "It's always been clear that the people in the Caribbean have Native American ancestry, but the region has such a complex history of migration, it was difficult to prove whether this was specifically indigenous to the Caribbean until now." The research also revealed a genetic link between the
Taino
and contemporary residents of northern South America. Arawakan languages, such as spoken by the
Taino,
had developed in the Amazon and the Orinoco basins. So it's just, this was something that was long believed by many people, and then also historians and also archaeologists, but now it's just...
They have the science to back
it up. It's another science.
Because there's a difference between being like, we have all these clay pots moving their way up all along the river, and now they're on the islands. Did that come there from trade? Did that come there from migration?
We don't, quote unquote, we don't know.
No.
You can't make a firm yes. So the news will come as no surprise to descendants who have been telling their children about their ancestors for years. The study's other lead author, Hans Schroeder from University of Copenhagen, called the finding fascinating. Many history books tell you the indigenous population of the Caribbean was all but wiped out. But people who self-identify as
Tainau
have always argued for continuity. Now we know they were right all along. There is some form of genetic continuity in the Caribbean.
You mean indigenous people were right?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And you mean it's like they survived? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Jorge Estevez, a Tainau descendant working in the National Museum of the American Indian in New York, assisted the project team. I wish my grandmother was alive today so I could confirm to her what she already knew. It shows the true story of one is assimilation, but certainly not of extinction. So there is a Carib reserve on the island of Dominica. Although these people don't live lives like the Caribs of the 16th century, we also don't live the lives of our European ancestors.
Cultures evolve.
Many other Caribbean nations now recognize the importance of their native heritage. Cultural heritage is protected on many islands where cultural resource management plans are being established before development is taking place. Museum and heritage parks are growing throughout the region. First peoples are being, quote unquote, brought back to life, as with history is alive and flourishing. December 5th is Discovery Day in Haiti, a day that has been used to commemorate the day when Christopher Columbus landed on the island of Hispaniola in 1492. In how many history books are there images of Christopher Columbus and in museums and exhibited in public places as statues? I think a lot of times we confuse the myths for history or a collection of facts as the start and end of a story. I personally believe that there would be as much, if not more, known about the
Tainaus
in Anacona as there is about Columbus, his exploits, if they were given the same time and focus and myth building. As for the legacy of Anacona, in Haiti, the people of Lilongwe are very proud of their queen, but unfortunately, there's only one statue of her in the public town where she was believed to be born.
Where do we put our energy towards? Who do we memorialize? We can go and find so many statues of Christopher Columbus, who didn't actually really meaningfully contribute anything. He did basically a giant misdirect in his desire for money. He didn't actually discover anything. He didn't build anything.
He didn't do anything that was helpful for anybody.
Exactly.
Except for himself.
Exactly. And the enrichment of other people. But even then, like, that enrichment was only for select few people. And yet we have so many statues of him. But instead of going and having, you know, the people who were actual meaningful leaders like Anacona or other indigenous leaders or people who were imported in the transatlantic slave trade, instead of going and having them being memorialized in these spaces and in these places where they matter more, we don't do that.
When you set up a statue to commemorate and honor someone, it's not just that one person, but it's who are they and what they stood for and what do they mean for the people at their time and what do they mean now?
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we ask ourselves, why are things the way they are in society, look at who's being lauded and set up on statuary as a hero. And we wonder, why don't we work in community? Why don't we help each other? Well, look at who we're pedestaling, people who are take mine and give nothing back.
Yeah. Or people who uphold, yeah, like certain types of values. You know, we're getting down to like the statue argument, right? And it's one of those things, like, it's not like a, you destroy the statues and we pretend that they didn't happen. It's a, okay, let's go and put this in a museum and then recontextualize this person.
Well, and tell the whole story.
Exactly.
And that's one thing that is good about having things like a statue, even of her, even if it's only one, it's a place for people to recognize and then also to say, well, who is that person?
Yeah.
And to find out their story and to find more about the history and the people. And so I think if anything, like I've said on this journey, take the time to think about who gets their story told. Why are they not getting their story told?
Mm-hmm.
How can you help find out their story and also learn about them so then you could tell their story so then they can continue onward?
And also even the people whose story is told quite frequently, really go and interrogate, why do we go and we hear these certain types of things about this person? Is this completely based on just fact? Or is it also, you know, their own
mythology?
Exactly.
Their own bullshit.
Yep.
So thank you for coming with me on my last book.
How does it feel for you? It's your last book.
It's bittersweet. It's like when you're in the middle of the marathon, you're just like, I don't want to run anymore. But as soon as you're done the race, you're just, man, that was great. I can't wait to sign up for the next marathon. There's no more marathons. Oh, I'll probably end up doing this on my own side projects, like just researching about people.
Yeah.
Send me recs about who you think I should research more just for myself.
Yeah, just for our own edification.
Follow us for more research, fun facts, soundtracks, and aesthetic posts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter at Royal Diaries Pod.